From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an exclusive report from CPR News. While the newspapers and cable news networks have been seemingly obsessive in their coverage of the missing Malaysian airliner, we've declined to join in the weeks-long speculation about what happened to the plane and its passengers in the absence of hard facts. However, on Tuesday, we received a report from a former high-ranking official in the Malaysian government that both includes a number of very important contextual facts and raises a number of important questions which we here at CPR News feel obliged to share with the public. First, something that's been missing from the commercial media's coverage, a little background about Malaysia. Since 1969, Malaysia has been a stubbornly independent country, a member of the non-aligned movement, practicing neutrality in international affairs. It was the first non-aligned Asian country to recognize China, and to this day, the two nations enjoy very close commercial and social ties. China is Malaysia's largest trading partner, and there's a sizable Chinese population in Malaysia. Mahathir bin Mohamad was the fourth prime minister of Malaysia, who held the post for 22 years from 1981 to 2003, making him the longest-serving prime minister of that country. His political career has spanned more than 40 years. His influence was evident as recently as 2009, when his backing of the current prime minister, Najib Razak, for the post was considered crucial. Matthias Chang is a Malaysian lawyer of Chinese descent who once served as the political secretary to Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad. He's been actively involved in the anti-war movement for more than four decades and is the author of three bestsellers, Future Fast Forward, Brainwashed for War Programmed to Kill, and The Shadow Money Lenders and the Global Financial Tsunami. In an interview early Tuesday with former six-term congressional representative Cynthia McKinney, he disclosed that there were two massive naval exercises involving the militaries of the U.S., Thailand, and Singapore underway in the region at the time that Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared, and he raised a number of questions that clearly deserve to be answered.
You are in Malaysia. You are the former chief of staff to the former Prime Minister Mahathir. So you're in a position to know Matthias Chang. You are in a position to know, and you're right there in Malaysia. Tell me from start to finish what your ideas and thoughts are about the missing Malaysia Airlines jet that has 239 people on board.
Well, in fact, this morning I wrote an article and I drew the attention of my readers a peculiar fact that has been missed by many people throughout the world, especially in Malaysia. Very few are aware that on a day that the plane so-called disappeared, there was two military exercises. I repeat, two military exercises conducted in Thailand. One was called Cobra Gold and the other was Cobra Tiger, involving the armed forces, air and naval forces of the United States of America, Thailand, Singapore, Indonesia, South Korea. Now, straight away you will recognize something is unusual. Malaysia is a third world country, a different country, and therefore it lacks the sophistication of the technologies that's available in the United States of America, Britain, all right, Australia, okay? Now, how can a plane that took off from Malaysia on the way to Beijing for no reason whatsoever turn back and disappear? There were several theories given for that disappearance. One of them was suicide by the pilot. That is so stupid, because why would he want to fly for 8 hours towards Indian Ocean, somewhere near Australia, to commit suicide? That's preposterous. It's a ridiculous theory. All right? Another question which we have to pose to the vested interest is this. How can the United States of America, Britain, Australia, and all the other military powers not able to trace the plane? Now, we are told that NSA can track every phone call of every citizen in the world. America has launched the most advanced satellites, allegedly, that could pinpoint an item the size of a 50-cent coin. A satellite that can see underground bunkers. Yet today, there's no information from any of these advanced satellites. Alright? The plane just disappeared. Another thing that's very curious is everyone seems to focus on the area near Australia. Now, if you look at the world map, for the plane which was flying away from Kuala Lumpur, from Malaysia towards Beijing, and then turned back and flew across Malaysia, then turned northwards towards Thailand, the Andaman Sea, and then southwards, alright, towards the Indian Ocean, any elementary school student who has basic knowledge of geography will notice that that flight path will come within the geographical parameters of the very important military base called Diego Garcia, in which the U.S. leads from Britain. This base is the most sophisticated military air and naval base, and has been used to launch wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and wars in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. You have the most advanced surveillance and radar in that naval base. Surely, if an identified plane is flying towards a direction, it would be a threat to the naval base, which also have nuclear submarines. Yet, no planes were launched to intercept this MH370. No radar reports that such a plane was in the path of that island. So the question is, what happened to the radar? What happened to all the satellites? It does not make sense. How can the most sophisticated systems of surveillance can't detect a missing, so-called missing plane, MH370? Go figure out, Cynthia.
Matthias, you mentioned the two exercises, and Cope Tiger and Cobra Gold. Did Malaysia participate in Cope Tiger as they did with Cobra Gold?
No.
Uh-huh.
Throughout history, the exercise were essentially three countries historically: U.S., Thailand, and Singapore. Recently, they include Indonesia, Korea, and Japan. And I think, and I believe Malaysia was an observer to those exercises. And this year, China was invited to be an observer, and they sent, I think, a team of 18 or 20 observers, that's all. Now, in such an exercise, obviously, you have the most advanced planes, fighter planes, flying in that whole area, the whole theater. You have naval ships, and more importantly, this year, 2014, exercises. There was a special exercise for search and rescue. So my question is very simple to those military assets, right? And those countries who participated in this exercise. On the announcement, the MH370 disappeared allegedly. What did they do? Did they respond? If not, why not? And subsequently, after the plane was so-called missing for 2 or 3 days, did the military exercise that was continued till 21st of March hindered the search and rescue? Or did they participate in the search and rescue? No details are forthcoming to today. There's no media coverage by international mass media as to whether or not the United States of America, the Thai, the Singaporean, right, air and naval forces responded to that, to the call. Total silence. Again, why? Our country has stated publicly that initially we had so much problems to get the cooperation, right, of countries to assist. And in the Reuters newspaper or news report, they interviewed some diplomats who took part in the high-level meeting in Kuala Lumpur to discuss about how to participate and how to effect a proper search and rescue mission. They said that many countries held back information for fear that they would disclose their technology, right, and their defense capabilities. Reuters did not disclose the name of the diplomat, but Reuters quoted that a diplomat said that it was almost like a spy novel, alright? And yet, Malaysia has been accused and lambasted, right, for being ignorant, incompetent, alright, a bumbling idiot in coordinating the rescue. How can we, a third world country, who had to rely on the advanced technologies of other countries, be responsible, right, for the disappearance of the plane or in its efforts to find the plane? We are a small country. We don't deny that our systems of surveillance, right, will be far inferior to that of US, Japan, France, Australia, or UK. Right? They were the person that helped. But to get information in dips and drabs, it doesn't make sense. And of course, the passengers, right, and the families of the passengers, right, were angry against Malaysia because they weren't aware that Malaysia was not in a position to give any information, as we were dependent on foreign countries who has the expertise to provide the information. Only recently, the Chinese families who formed the bulk of the passengers in the flight MH370 realized that, in fact, Malaysia is not to be blamed.
Mm-hmm.
But initially, there was a lot of friction, and we suspect that the friction and the unhappiness on the part of Chinese families and public was a provoked action, because I think there are forces who doesn't want a harmonious relationship between China and Malaysia. Malaysia is in a very critical position in the Straits of Malacca. It's also a Muslim country.
Mm-hmm.
That is friendly to China. Alright? So if there's any friction between China and Malaysia, we have asked the question, who benefits from this discord? Malaysia and China has been very harmonious Malaysia is the first country in Southeast Asia to recognize China. All right? Before any other country. And we have a growing trade relationship. And China is our largest trading partner. So there are some hidden forces trying to create animosity between the people of China and Malaysia. It's my hope that this, in time to come, will be resolved. As I believe it will be, because recently the people in China have realized what is going on, and they have, through the mass media, called for calm and understanding that the matter can be resolved and will be resolved, and that Malaysia is not to be blamed for the lack of information.
So you see a geopolitical, geostrategic objective, and I agree with you that the two exercises are extremely important, but I don't believe that this information of the two exercises was made public.
Unfortunately, it was not. Why? Why the silence?
That's right. So are there any other questions or coincidences that you think are striking?
Well, the most striking, if you recall, right, is that for almost 2 weeks, no one knew where the plane was missing. Now, as you know, right, Australia, right, forms an important network of surveillance, as Edward Snowden has disclosed, that Australia was also partaking with NSA for surveillance. Don't you think it's odd that the first country that disclosed that the plane could have crashed in the ocean was Australia? They announced that the satellite showed two items floating in the sea. Okay? And then resources were diverted to the area, but they couldn't find the two so-called missing objects. Subsequently, France came in and said their satellites had discovered two objects which could be from MH370. But later, it was discovered there was nothing there at the site in which the satellite supposedly identified two objects. Then come Thailand. Thailand satellite showed there were 200 objects floating in that area. Search parties went to the place and discovered they were all basically rubbish floating in the sea. Then Japan came along and said they found further objects. And again it was discovered they had nothing to do with MH370. Then out of the blues, the English firm by the name of Inmarsat said that by their technology, they calculated the plane could have crashed in that part of the Indian Ocean. All right? And following that disclosure, our government said that well, it's most likely that the plane crashed in that area. Let's pause for a while. So you have, right, a few countries saying that their satellites have indicated certain things, okay, all of which turn out not to be correct because the objects that the satellite showed weren't the objects from the plane. Inmarsat from UK didn't say that they could determine for sure the plane crashed in the Indian Ocean, but they said by their calculation, the plane could have crashed in that area. Then what happened was, Boeing subsequently said the plane could have flew faster because they flew at a lower altitude, and therefore they could have crashed 1,000 miles further north from the place in which it was earlier estimated to have crashed. Thereafter, the UK firm Inmarsat said that, well, we ought to be responsible for this, change of position, location of the crash. We merely provided information to the Malaysian government. Yet, that information was incorrect because now they say that it's most probably 1,000 miles away from the original position which everyone said it was there. But again, There's no evidence. None of the experts thus far ever mentioned that there's no information coming up publicly from any US satellites or UK satellites. Because Inmarsat is a private firm.
Yes, that's right.
Right? How come the United States, which has satellites, okay, and the surveillance headquarters, what GSQ is it? The British equivalent of NSA, all right,
mm-hmm.
are monitoring even phone conversation as NSA. How is it officially their satellites, their radar, show nothing? They were mute. Why? Very strange. Everybody says they're assisting Malaysia. Fine. We are grateful for the assistance. But is it really assistance? Or there's more to it? Why the silence?
Matthias, you've mentioned the absence of satellite data, which you are correct in pointing out that the United States satellites can they can read license plates from out in space. They can have facial recognition. So these satellites have been mute, at least the discussion about what the evidence is from the satellite is mute. You've mentioned also Diego Garcia, which has not been mentioned. I have been there as a result of it's used as a refueling station, among other things. And so surely there would be some intelligence coming out of Diego Garcia, but that is not mentioned. You mentioned also the NSA, which is listening in on every cell phone of everyone on the planet. And yet the NSA has not offered any of its intelligence that would allow us to understand what might have happened. And then you mentioned Cope Tiger and Cobra Gold. So it seems to me that there are four areas in which there might be evidence, but that evidence has not been forthcoming. What do these four things all have in common?
Well, the intelligence establishment is hiding something. They're not disclosing for reasons, right? Best known to them. I can't speculate because I'm not in the position to speculate because I don't have the evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But no one can say that the intelligence establishment of all the advanced countries do not know what's happening. It's not just impossible, okay? Now, this is most unusual. In every case where something is missing, right, more so like a plane, okay, it is a hijack. The hijackers were either give a statement, all right, or some propaganda statement to show that they were what to hijack. If it's a suicide, they would normally, by law, by past practices, right, case studies, if you commit a suicide, you invariably leave a suicide note, right? Or evidence that you are of that personality. No such evidence. In this case, all right, every possible scenario leaves a blank.
Well, until there is evidence that the plane actually crashed, you can't really conclude that there was a suicide.
Precisely. And neither can you say the plane crashed in the Indian Ocean. Alright? And I believe not now that they are saying that, right? Look, the black box will only emit signals for about 34 days. Okay? Without about 3 or 4 days left before the whole thing dies down. They're already saying that, right? If they can't look at the black box,
yes,
it's almost impossible to locate the plane. Are they preparing public opinion to say that, right, this is an unsolved mystery? How can the plane disappear out of this earth in the context, in the light of all the advanced technologies? It doesn't make sense. So, we should not be focusing on how the plane disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
If a crime is committed, right, we should not be focusing on the weapon that committed a crime. Be it the gun that killed someone, the knife that killed someone, the baseball bat that killed someone. That's not important. What is important is, right, who is the killer? Who is the perpetrator of the crime? Right?
Mm-hmm.
So a plane has disappeared for no reason. It must be a criminal act, one way or another. All right? Because lives are lost. It's missing. 239 people. Okay? They could have died. We don't know. Who will have a motive and the capability? And the key word is, who has the motive and the capability to disappear a plane? It's not a conspiracy theory, all right, or speculation to say there's some entity or some country who has the technology may have caused the disappearance of the plane for a purpose or agenda which we don't know, which may, in due course, expose itself. But we cannot discount that this possibility.
You're a trained lawyer, so you know what to look for when you're trying to solve a problem. And this is a problem-solving exercise. So for the families of those who are on the plane, do you have any parting words about how this investigation ought to responsibly be taken so that we will know that no scenario has been discounted or left out?
Well, at the present moment, I mean, we have to really sympathize with the families of the passengers because they must be suffering one hell of a, you know, of pain and anguish because they don't know what's happening, all right? And how can they give up hope when the plane has not been found? And this is terrible. This is a terrible mental torture for the families. And if the responsible organizations and countries who are part of this SAR mission, search and rescue mission, are not forthcoming, are not transparent by disclosing their technology, then it is a great disservice to humanity. Whichever country has the technology and the capabilities to tell for sure, all right, the cause of the disappearance of the plane and is holding back information cannot be forgiven.
Matthias, the stakes are very high, and there probably are people on the inside who have begun to ask themselves the same questions that you are asking. People who participated in these exercises and people who are now participating in the search and rescue efforts.
I'm betting there'll be a whistleblower. That's the only way we can get information now, if there's a whistleblower.
So basically, for all of us, and especially for the families and the victims, it's important that a whistleblower come forward and state what is not being stated by the entities that are involved that might have more information than has been put forward in the media.
I believe so. Because as you say, the stakes are very high. Whoever's involved in investigating this incident at whichever level, will be compelled by the environment, by security protocol, to follow certain lines of questioning or investigation. They'll be restricted what they can do, what can say. All right? But I believe a time will come where it becomes very obvious to those who are concerned in this investigation that they themselves will realize something's not right. Their conscience will prick them and they will come out. It's my hope, it's my prayer that sooner, not later, some courageous person, be it a man or woman, will come forward.
The Moral Mondays protests, which started out in North Carolina, have spread to South Carolina and Georgia. Dozens of protesters were arrested recently, demanding that their states agree to expand Medicaid coverage for the poor as a part of the Obamacare health plan. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford spoke with author and activist Kevin Alexander Gray about the difficulties involved in organizing people who are struggling with basic issues of survival.
The problem that we have in organizing in the South on something like Medicaid expansion, which means you're trying to get more poor people, the poorest of the poor, insured. It's hard to organize that group. That group doesn't have the financial wherewithal to come to a protest. They're not thinking about a protest. They're thinking about surviving for the most part. You know, a lot of those folk are working under the table. They work for less than minimum wage. They've got all the problems that go along with being poor. There's that. But when you're talking about organizing against people in power and the people that support them, we're not as organized as we were, let's say, 20, 30 years ago. We don't have the people capital right now that we had 20, 30 years ago. And I don't know where the progressive money is going, but I certainly haven't seen a lot of it going into doing community building and fighting the kinds of pressures that we're seeing in predominantly black and working class communities. We don't see the money, as I said, for really organizing to do the education on why it's important to expand Medicaid. There may be some white progressive groups that are getting money to do navigator programs and sign people up. And there's a little bit of money to do that, but not enough to where you can really move people to protest with the protest power where power resides.
However, the Democrats and their affiliated labor unions are raising hundreds of millions of dollars for electoral activity. The Moral Monday people are essentially defending a Democratic program, Obamacare. So why isn't there enough money to go around?
You know, there's Obama's Organized for America. Who knows what it does? There's Obama talking about Brothers Keepers Initiative. Who knows what it will be about? You know, there's organizing that's from the top down, and it's about Democratic votes in places that are probably easy to win. There's no heavy lifting or organizing in the South to deal with the Southernization of American politics and this implicit racism that's engendered in Southern politics. There's no real organizing where the bulk or the majority of black people live in this country, and it hasn't been for a long time. I'm hopeful that something will emerge because there is activity, and it's core activity. It's not mass activity, but it is starting to shake loose of the 6 years that people have been anesthetized with Obama in office. I see that unthawing, but there's still a lot of work to be done. There's new organizations to develop. There are new organizations to develop that need to be black-led and led by the folk who are most in need of change, and certainly not led by just a white liberal coterie of people that get constant funding.
A group of students from Stanford spoke with imprisoned activist Mumia Abu-Jamal about the situation of political prisoners in the United States. We have this clip from Prison Radio.
Hi, Mumia. My name is Christian Bailey. We're a group of college students. We're mostly in our 20s. Our generation missed a lot of the context of political imprisonments of the 70s and the 60s. And so for us, we're very divorced from the issue of people being incarcerated for political reasons. So I'm curious what you think we can be thinking about or doing to sort of bridge the gap between our generation recognizing and interacting more with those who are behind bars.
I understand that. That's a very good question, Christian. Let me say two things, if I may. And with all due respect, I really do believe that my book, We Want Freedom, will answer a lot of questions because it's written about that period extensively with a lot of, I think, honesty and insight into the failures of many of us of that generation, but also what we faced. But there's also, thanks to new media, recently a young sister in her 30s, I believe, did a documentary on Angela Davis called Free Angela Davis and All Political Prisoners. We were lucky enough to see it on BET, of all places. It shocked that it's there, but it was there at least once or twice. I would advise anybody who's interested to spend an hour, maybe an hour and a half, and watch it, because there you'll see real news footage of what was happening during that period. You wouldn't have read this in your history lessons, but it's there. And it's true, and it's real, and it's actual footage. And I think a lot of people can learn a lot from that. And I think it should be passing, really, from mind to mind and eyeball to eyeball, because people will learn the repressive nature of the state firsthand. You know, people don't know it today. Angela Davis is known as a scholar and an activist. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, they tried to give her 3 death penalties. And they lost. But, yeah, that's a lesson to learn. I have to go, my friends. I thank you for your question.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.